Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
On a mixtape just around the corner, did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like song, and then my song's gon' break through like
a hello, and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Today is Thursday, April 11th, 2024. My goodness, almost halfway through April, and to sit here and revel in the misery of a rapidly disappearing year, I say that 3.5 months into the year, anyways, is Mr. Mark Hamilton. Hammy, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. I don't like the way you frame that. So I hear you on the one hand, the year is going by way too quick, but the good news is we are on the cusp of
summer, right? That's true.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have 7 or 8 months of darkness and dampness and wetness. Yep. We have a summer coming, but the problem is I have a feeling it's going to be a very long, very hot summer, and there's going to be some pretty fierce water restrictions. But on the other hand, I get to go to the water park. I don't know, but I'm happy, dude. I'm happy. I'm good.
How are you? I'm doing good. You know, it's kind of cool to be able to sit down and do this this afternoon, like during the day rather than at like 3 a.m. when like
no, stop. I have coworkers that listen to this podcast. We are recording at 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Thursday.
There we go. Okay.
All right. 9 p.m.
That's right. It's all good. Anyways, we're sitting down here and it is, yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, we're halfway through April. That means we've got like a, you know what, like a third, no, not a third, not even a quarter, a fifth of the season under our belts. And there was big news today, Fernando Alonso announcing a new contract. Did you see what they did on social media that with Fernando? He had like a little like video. I guess he tried to copy like Sebastian Vettel's retirement announcement. Remember when Seb released that video a couple of years ago and he kind of did like, you know, announcing his retirement, and like Fernando did kind of the same thing. I don't know if it landed with the same impact, but I thought it was a little bit cheeky. Anyways, we'll talk about that in a minute. And like, first of all, I just want to give a shout out to Magnus and the crew over at the Race Weekend magazine. You can check them out at theraceweekend.com. That's RACEWKND.com, and use Scuderia Pod at checkout to receive a 10% discount on a subscription. And also check out racingexclusives.com for unique Formula One merch and memorabilia. Check them out and see what Tease and the crew have over there in the store. Oh, man, I don't know if I want to go down the Drivers and Constructors Championship. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. I know what the folks really want to listen to or find out is the update with the fantasy standings. I had them here a couple of minutes ago. So we were having a little bit of a laugh here because it just looks so ridiculous every time we log in to see that our league name, so the Scuderi F1 Pod or Podcast Fantasy League, has been replaced by like a 16 digit number because apparently the sensors had an issue with that. It makes me laugh all the time. Anyways, just looking at it again, the Red Beards in first place, Kerry Duro F1 have dropped down into second. Nakunda Racing, Betancur Williams team is up into third. DJ Bean is down into fourth. Holding steady at fifth is Tails I Win, so that's Andy Taylor's team. Also hanging there in sixth place is another team with a long and ridiculous name. That's Kwame Sarpong's team. Down into seventh is Hamilton, eight-time champions. Down into eighth is Nick Pobednik's F1 team. It's like this. Last year's champion, Michael Cronier, breaking into the top 10 for the first time this season. And then moving up into 10th for the first time this season is Goldstone. I'm looking for some of the more, you know, I'm looking for Bengals Bubs. I haven't seen Bengals Bubs this year. I don't know if they put a team in. Anyways, good fun coming up in the season ahead.
And,
yes.
And Daly, where are you in this fantasy pool right
Dude,
now?
Dude, you know, I made my one set of, you know, changes for the year. So it was a really small team, like league this year, because they took forever to approve it. And even though like it took forever for the league to become visible. And have you noticed like over the last couple of years, like 2 years ago, we had what about like 800 entrants or something like that?
Yeah. 2000.
Yeah.
Year, I think.
Yeah. And I set it up like the day it went live. And apparently, you know, they like went in limbo. And then, so like by the time it was all said and done, we got about 150 entries because like I tweeted it out or X'd it out or whatever it is. And because it just wasn't visible, we didn't get nearly as many sort of like random folks joining up. But yeah. Anyways, I think I'm sitting up 140th out of 150. So. Pretty sad times. Full disclosure.
Yeah, I'll just add as well, by the way, and I hope you prefaced the invitation to people joining this pool, this fantasy league, that when it comes time to send out the grand prize this year, which is nestled snugly in my living room right now between the sofa and a pillow, when we
that's
go
a weird
to send
place
it out,
to keep it.
I don't know why. So I put it there because I meant to give it to you at the watch party like 5 months ago, and I just never moved it. And so it's still sitting there. I don't know if you've ever told people what the prize is, but it's pretty good. But I'm just going to say this right now, that if you live beyond, I don't know, 100 kilometers from where you and I live, like you're banned from winning the prize. Like I'm not shipping the prize. Last year's winner was amazing, and I love him dearly, and he was fantastic. I'm not sending a prize to another country that far away again. It's very expensive. So just know that if you are currently stationed in Antarctica on a scientific study, I will send it to your aunt in Kansas, but we're not sending it to Antarctica.
I know. Isn't it kind of like ridiculous how
shipping is so expensive,
you
man.
You know, I don't know like why it is that way sometimes, especially I guess that you know, sometimes when you hear like some of the shipping costs, and like if you go to buy something, I guess it's just cheaper if you do it obviously in bulk. But yeah, we've got some other options. So one of the guys I work with has a clothing company, or his wife does. So that gives us some options to finally do some merch, which I don't know if that's actually easy. Maybe you could just stick a couple of stamps on a t-shirt or a hoodie and stuff it in the mailbox.
So, but Daly, that's the problem, right? Which is when it came to the merch, like I have such high standards for what I
Me
want
too.
It to be. Yeah. Like, I don't want it to be some silk screen piece of garment. Like, it's got to be embroidered with patches and all that kind of cool stuff. Have you shared, because I've been in a coma for a couple of months. I haven't actually been in a coma. Don't so anyone
figuratively, not literally.
Asking me about how it happened. Did you share with people what the grand prize is this year? Or maybe I don't know what the grand prize is.
I think I did. I mean, it is a Pierre Gasly half-scale helmet, which was very
there
nicely shared and signed from Thies and the crew over Racing Exclusives. And, you know, we will throw some t-shirts and things in there. That we can get done too. So that's pretty exciting. Again, you're right to keep those things away from me, you know, because, you know, unlike you, you have no like attachment to them. You're very generous. Me, I get rather like Gollum-esque. I'm like, my precious, you know, and
yeah, or you just lose it in your beard somewhere.
That's right. Or my kids will take it. And well, they wouldn't.
Yeah.
I would take it and I would blame my children, which I guess is kind of, you know, shallow and mean on my part, but it is what it is. But I should use that as a segue, shallow and mean, because I was going to start talking about Fernando Alonso. And I thought that's even a little bit, you know, too far. Anyways, the two-time world champion announced today that he's signed a contract extension with Aston Martin that's going to keep him there until the end of 2026. He's 42 years old now, and apparently he was convinced by Lawrence Stroll to stay. Did you hear that story the other week, Mark? That Eddie Jordan has this theory that Aston Martin next year will be a duo of Fernando Alonso and Carlos Sainz. You know, it was one of these like little random things I don't even remember now if it was a full story, if it was just like a post on social media, it could have been like a little video or audio clip or something like that. But he actually said that is his thing, that he doesn't believe it's out of the realm of possibility that it could be an all Spanish 1-2 at Aston Martin next year. What would you think? Would you be up for that? Are you Team Carlos? Because I'm like, you know, in your absence, I dubbed this like the Carlos Sainz, like fan club. Not that I hate Lewis or I begrudge Lewis for going to Ferrari, but I love a good underdog story, and I'm kind of like pulling for Carlos for something good to happen for him in his next move in F1.
I guess that's going to be a big story through the back half of this season, right? Yeah. Which is, well, we know who's going to win the championship, but there's still a little bit of silly season to play out, and you could certainly do much worse than Carlos Sainz. And I suppose that's presumptive in just kind of assuming that Lance Stroll won't have the seat next year. But I've said it so many times in the past that if you're Lawrence Stroll and you're investing so much money, it's a $1 billion project, you know, you're significantly stunting your growth by not putting the best possible driver in that car. And I don't think there's any argument that Carlos Sainz, if he's available, is a better candidate to drive next to Fernando Alonso than is Lance Stroll. And I love Lance Stroll, Canadian kid from Montreal. All that said, I think Carlos Sainz probably wants to just kind of wait around and see what other options kind of become available to him in the offseason. But I guess, you know, through the process of kind of, I don't think this is the proper expression, but the process of elimination, you can probably start to calculate what seats will be available and which ones could be compelling. But yeah, I think that would be an exciting lineup, and I would be very happy for him to have that, man. And just this Fernando Alonso piece, man, like I just brought up his Wikipedia in the background. Like, I know how long he's been in F1, but when I bring up his Wikipedia site and you see every season of his career starting in 2001, man, like I have very little memory of 2011, let alone 2001.
It's crazy.
Like, just think about the world in 2001. He was been driving in F1 before the horrific events of 9/11, that everything that unfolded after that, he was racing in F1 as it happened, the global economic crisis, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, like all of these kind of world-changing events, he's been in F1 for all of them. It's crazy, like almost a quarter of a century. Well, I guess this will take him a quarter of a century, right? So the deal will take him through 2026, which would be the first year they're partnered with Honda. So 25 years, and I guess that you have to kind of make an exception for that year or two he was out, but like pretty strong run for a quarter of a century.
It's absolutely mind-blowing when you put it that way, that it's going all the way back to 2001. How old would he have been when he broke into it? So if he's 42 now, going back, geez, I mean, he was what, 18 when he got into F1? He was just he must have been, right? I'm just doing the math anyways. It's far too late in the day to actually do math like properly, but just an amazing career. And it's just, when he went back to McLaren in, what was that, 2015 or whatever it was, and that disastrous year and a half or whatever it is, and all the misfires, you know, literal and figurative that we had. And then when he walked away from, I thought he was done in Formula One, and then he comes back and has like this, you know, yet another renaissance or rebirth or whatever. It's crazy just how many times he's reinvented himself in the sport.
D-Town, let me just run people through his career. So 2001, European Minardi F1, he makes the transition in 2003 full-time to mild 7 Renault F1. I shouldn't be giving credit to a tobacco company, but 2003, 4, 5, 6, he is with the Renault F1 team. Of course, and this is always the crazy thing, before the 2006 season, a season in which he won the Drivers' Championship, he signed with McLaren Mercedes. So he knew for the entirety of the 2006 season in which he won a championship that he was going to to McLaren Mercedes. In 2007, McLaren Mercedes, if you want to know about that, just go back to that episode that you and I did with Bert Pinkerton a couple of years ago to discover what a complete and utter disaster that season was on so many different levels. And then he goes back to Renault. So he goes back to Renault for three more seasons, during which, of course, Crashgate happens and that whole team is basically torn apart. Then he spends 2010 and 2011 with the Ferrari team. Actually, how many years was he with Ferrari? 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. Yeah, a really long run. And then, to your point, he makes the transition to McLaren Honda, which was a complete disaster. Still manages to hang in there for 4 years, then comes back for a couple of years with Alpine. The Alpine relationship falls apart halfway through 2022 when they're not willing to offer him a deal. And then he spent the last year and a half with Aston Martin. Like, what a career that is.
I know, it's crazy. And the other thing that's like that really blows my mind about Fernando Alonso, Hammy, is the fact that it seems like he's burnt so many bridges in Formula One. I think that if mere mortals like ourselves had burned bridges in our jobs and careers the way that Fernando did in Formula One, we would have been, you know, undesirable long, long ago. But somehow he's managed to always find a way back in. And it was so funny because, you know, I remember talking about it with you last year. I think it was after the Miami Grand Prix, because I specifically remember that he was being interviewed on the grid by Danica Patrick. And there he was, big smile and laughing and jovial. And I'm just like, it was such a weird thing because I just couldn't reconcile that version of Fernando Alonso with the love-hate relationship of the Fernando Alonso I thought I knew before that moment in time. It was really strange. And I'd come to this one point in my own, you know, my own mind with Fernando Alonso. It's like, oh, I just don't like this guy. It's just like, once he goes from Formula One, I'll be glad to see him go. And then
I was totally there. Was totally there, man.
And then he comes back and he's with Aston Martin. It's like this, I don't know, maybe he's just mellowed now because he's like 87 years old. He's almost as old as I am. And, you know, it's not quite accurate, but it's also not completely, you know, wrong either, just for context, because I'm old and so is he. anyways, it just is amazing to see how, you know, this version of Fernando Alonso at Aston Martin is, you know, completely different to what we've experienced over the years. And that's why it's not really too much of a surprise, right? But I thought it was kind of interesting too. Maybe it was just himself positioning like or using the media a little bit for leverage, because I know there was a couple of things kind of like bubbling up to the surface in the past couple of years, not years, but past couple of weeks, that he was kind of looking around, keeping his options open kind of thing. And there was some of these like you know, potential like Fernando to Mercedes rumors and stuff like that. But I guess, you know, what they've offered him, because like what he said, it's a lifetime project at Aston Martin. And so he said after announcing the contract, he said, quote, "It's a lifetime project in a way for me. This is the longest contract I ever signed in my career. This is something that will keep me linked to Aston for many, many years to come. Let's see which role. Let's see how many more years I drive. But even after driving, I will use 25 plus years of experience in Formula One, plus another 10 of 15 outside of F1. So nearly 40 years motorsports experience at the benefit of a team that gave me this opportunity now in this moment of my career. So this is very appealing for me, and I'm very motivated for the next years to come," end quote. So interesting. I mean, the one thing is too, is he's going to be around till like the next regulatory cycle. He's going to be there when Honda comes back in to become, and they're going to become like an official Honda Works team, which is kind of crazy with all the things I mean we've become used to. And Hammy, like I'm still confused. I mean, we've been talking about this for years. Like, are Honda officially in Formula One or are they not? Like, is the HRC just some sort of figment of my imagination? Because I'm still like completely confused on the whole topic.
Dude, somebody has to write a book about Honda's weird kind of experience with F1, that they've dominated at some points. They've been kind of bottom of the pack at other points. They've been in the sport officially, but, and yeah, it's so crazy, right? Like, I remember one of the first shows that you and I did, we were sitting here reflecting on the fact that Honda was going to exit the sport. Yep. And it felt like they were on the cusp of something great with Red Bull. And then of course they win a title, they still exit the sport, but they're quietly supplying power units to Red Bull. In the meantime, Red Bull continues to dominate. And then they quietly strike a deal to kind of put the Honda badge on the car. But then the Honda F1 team is taken over by HRC, which typically does the MotoGP kind of package. Like, the whole thing's very strange. So I don't know what their official status is with F1, but you're right. They're going to come back in 2026. And the weird thing about the Aston Martin link up is Aston Martin uses Mercedes components today, the gearbox and the drivetrain, which makes total sense because the Aston Martin road car division sources their drivetrains from Mercedes, and Mercedes owns a chunk of the Aston Martin road car division. So it's always kind of made sense that there was that tie-up between Aston Martin and Mercedes. But it's very strange that Aston Martin, who is a road car producer, again, supercars, who sources their power units from Mercedes, is going to become a works team for Honda. It's very, 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 very Again, I guess this is just what F1's like, very peculiar.
Yeah, and then there's also the other tie-in, because doesn't Toto Wolff, does he not have shares or ownership? Like, is it, well, I think he's got shares in the road car division, but is there some tie-in to the F1 team now? I can't remember, because it is just so confusing. Excuse me, in the way that it's all kind of like tied together. But I think that's what really makes the whole story really compelling, right? Is that you've got Aston Martin, which Lawrence Stroll has resurrected, from the shell of Racing Point or Force India, if you want to dial it back that far. And he buys Aston Martin, and he's got this existing Formula One team, which he rebrands into like Aston Martin as a race team, Formula One team, and with the Mercedes tie-in, but then the Honda connection, and then Honda leaving sort of kind of Red Bull, and then them partnering up, or Red Bull at any rate, partnering up with Ford for the Red Bull Powertrains division for 2026. It's sometimes very, very difficult to really keep track of these things. But I think the other thing that is interesting too with Fernando, because maybe it's not quite on the scale that, with some of the things that Lewis is going to get out of his deal with Ferrari moving forward into the future, is that I can't help but thinking that Mercedes really dropped the ball when it came to Lewis, because, we've sat here for the last couple of years. It seems every time Lewis would go through contract negotiations, we're kind of speculating, like, what else could Mercedes do to sweeten the pot? Like, part ownership in the team, an ambassador role and everything like that. And it really sounds like they never actually wanted to, or could never really extend that offer to Lewis Hamilton. And then Ferrari come in and, offer him basically whatever he wanted to go race there for a couple years. It's just it's amazing. And I think that it's sort of the same idea for Fernando Alonso, because he said he had a one-year offer on the table somewhere else, but the whole Aston Martin thing was just way more attractive for him.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, we're there. We're to the one.
We're 10 minutes into this topic. Moving on.
The other thing that's interesting too is just some of the comments from Mike Crack, the team principal of Aston Martin, who says that the team is what he calls no longer in a no man's land and can actually run and lead the group in races, which I don't know. I mean, I think on paper we're seeing something, but I think after watching the first 3-4 races of the season, I think that the Constructors' Championship really shakes out exactly the way what we've seen over the first opening series of races for this year, because you got Red Bull that's out front at the moment, Ferrari not too far behind, then there's a fairly sizable gap in the constructors, because Ferrari has 120 points, McLaren has 70 or 69, pardon me, then Mercedes has 34 and Aston Martin have 34. So it's really is reflective of what we've seen. And Aston Martin and Mercedes, I mean, there's obviously been Red Bull, except for in Australia when, Max had the retirement and Sergio Perez was a non-factor and it was all Ferrari that weekend. And McLaren has kind of been there, but not quite. And then Mercedes and Aston Martin have kind of been not really up there with McLaren either. So I feel like that's a bit of a stretch in Mike Crack's, comments, but I guess what he's like, trying at least to say that maybe they've started to break out of that, I don't know what you want to call it, that mold or that place that they've been in. Because he says here, quote, "I think we can agree that we're not in no man's land, and that's positive, because here with that high degradation and you can pass, when we have seen that you can pass in incredible places, although I wasn't aware that you can pass through the S's," he's talking about Suzuka here, "but you can see a large enough delta or pace delta, entire delta, you could do it if you're brave enough, but we did not seem to be in no man's land. We seemed to be in the pack. We were ahead of Mercedes, so that is very encouraging." I don't know. Like, I feel that the Aston Martin so far this year, Mark, is not quite where it was last year. It's they tailed off, and I don't feel like they've really brought it back to where it was before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. And it's interesting too, because typically when I see a team depreciating from a performance perspective, it's often a question of, are they performing worse or is another team taking points off them because they're improving? So sometimes it's not that you're doing things worse, it's just that other teams are improving at a more rapid pace. And, you know, if you look at the world constructor standings right now, Red Bull atop, as we would expect, Ferrari's pretty close on 120 points. Of course, that's also bolstered by the fact that Max Verstappen had a DNF. McLaren Mercedes is sitting in third on 69 points, so almost half of where Ferrari is. And then you are, Aston Martin, you are still only a point off of Mercedes, but I think that probably says a lot more about the current state of the Brackley Brixworth team than it does about you. And for sure, like if you flash back to this point last year, I think you and I were, excited about Aston Martin in 2021 and 2022.
Couple of years.
And it feels like they last year, they finally delivered on, I think, what we had hoped they would be able to deliver. And if you remember last year, right, like I'm trying to remember how he started the season, but Fernando Alonso, yeah, three straight podiums. I just brought it up here. He had three straight podiums, five podiums in the first six races, and they're certainly not contending for podium spaces right now. But again, I think that probably also speaks to the fact that Ferrari really struggled at the beginning of last season. I think they only scored one or two podiums before Great Britain, and then they had another five or six after that. So maybe it's just the fact that Ferrari's in such a great place that they're taking a lot of those points off of them, but you're right that they're nowhere where they were last year. And then the other thing too, and I keep playing this in the back of my head, man, is we have 1 year left in the current regulation set. Yep. You spoke a couple of minutes ago that we're approaching that new regulatory cycle. My concern is, and I know that the sport's trying to implement rules to prevent this, but when do teams that are in the middle of the pack start devoting all of their resources to 2026, right? That like that you could look ahead and say, hey, we could devote 100% of our money and our resources to the 2025 car and our ceiling is this, probably a top five finish. Or maybe, you know what, we don't devote any resources and our ceiling is a top six finish. Maybe we should be putting those resources towards 2026. So my fear is that if this year plays out as we kind of expect it to do with a really strong Red Bull Ferrari 1-2, that if you're anyone else on the grid, it's a lost cause. It's a sunk cost investing in 2025, that you need to start investing your resources towards 2026, which is totally what we saw in 2013, yep. Right? That everyone carried over the chassis, the power units, they weren't investing because they were going completely refreshed for 2014. But yeah, to answer your question, they're certainly not where they were at this point last
year. Yeah, I mean, just sort of talking about like going to this next regulatory cycle in 26. I mean, we're far enough into this, you know, and we have been for some time, that the cycle that we're in now has been a swing and a miss. I mean, I remember looking at, when did they come out with those concept drawings for like the cars that we have now? Was that about like 2017, 2018? It wasn't too long after Liberty took over from Bernie Ecclestone. Everybody say, oh my God, like the cars are going to be so radically future, different. Yeah. It's going to be amazing and it's going to be a whole new era. And it's interesting because when you go back to the end of the last cycle, it was fairly competitive. I mean, it wasn't always great and sunshine and lollipops and all that stuff, but before 2022, but at least towards the end there was like they were a little bit closer. And then we've had those ongoing you know, issues with the porpoising and things like that. And it's funny too, because you know, when you're sort of you know, making that comparison between Aston Martin and Mercedes just now, is not a great comp, because Mercedes have been struggling for such a long time now. And it was so funny, because like before the Japanese Grand Prix last week, you know, what was it Lewis was saying after practice or qualifies, like, oh, this is like been like one of the best days outing, or you know, the best that the car has felt like in 3 years or something like that. And we go through the entire weekend, and then like the verdict after was, well, this was a horrible weekend, you know, nothing really went the way that we wanted. And I'm just like, it seems like it's just more and more of the same. And I'm just you know, constantly having my mind blown that they just can't seem to get you know, to get out of it. And you sort of like compare that to Ferrari, because it's interesting, some of the comments, like when you hear Frédéric Vasseur talking about like the car maybe is not quite as pacey as it was compared to like last year's car, but overall the package itself is much better than they had last year. And it's interesting too, because you know, as somebody that's like, you know, typically had a soft spot for Ferrari over the years, that I'm afraid to love again. I'm afraid I'm going to get hurt, because I really feel now that a year and a bit into Frédéric Vasseur's 10-year mark, that I feel that we're starting to see his influences on the team. But I just kind of like, it seems every time something's going right, I get really, I wouldn't say anxious, but, you know, like really wound up that they're going to make that one stupid call from the pit wall, or they're going to have that one kind of like Ferrari moment that we've all become used to over the years. You know what I mean?
Yep. I'm so conditioned to you. I think I know when you're going to pivot to a new subject without giving me the opportunity to respond. And I thought that was going to be one of those moments. But yeah, I just totally agree with you on all of those fronts, buddy.
Okay, well, that's cool. Let's park this right here. We're going to take a break, because we're going to come back, because this is something I've been really wanting to talk to you about for a while, and that's Andretti. So they've been doing some...
They've
made some...
Let's skip break. Let's go right to... No, take a break.
Okay, let's pay some bills. So we're going to take a quick break. Be back on the flip side, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton sitting here on a very rainy and gloomy Thursday here in Vancouver, Canada. And let's talk about Andretti. So they've formally opened a very large 40,000 square foot facility with an aero department already in situ adjacent to Silverstone. Apparently, they're going to eventually take over a 70,000 square foot building nearby. So this design department and race team is going to be doing a lot of work on a 2026 Formula One car, should a entry finally be granted to them. And this is actually kind of unexpected for me, because January now that F1 announced that that Andretti hadn't crossed the bar. There was all these, I thought, you know, like a lot of the reasons that they had in that statement were quite preposterous. But Michael Andretti said at a ceremony at the new facility on Wednesday, quote, F1 is obviously the pinnacle of auto racing in the world. We're in all different types of racing series, but to be in F1 is at the top. And so that's why I think for our brand, it'd be huge. And it'll just complete our goal. And that is to be in every single major sporting racing event in the world. And then obviously getting to F1 is the top of that. So it's a big goal. It's been a goal of ours for a few years now, and we're right there. We're going to be there, and we feel very strongly that we're going to be there, and we're building a fantastic team as well. This is something that's going to be unique to F1, to build a real F1 team from scratch with great brains. And this is something that I think could catch a lot of people off guard when we do finally get on the grid, end quote. I don't know what to think of this, Mark. I mean, they are awfully aggressive in the way that they've pursued this. I mean, this is going back to, I don't even remember when you and I first talked about this. When was it that he offered, what was it, like $230 million or $320 million, whatever it was, for the Sauber team? And that's going back, what, at least 2021? 2-3 years ago at least, and that never happened. Obviously, that eventually became what's going to be the Audi 2026 works team, and then Andretti's own. I mean, they've been kind of like, I wouldn't say reckless, but they've been quite brash. Remember, was it Miami? I guess was the first year that the Michael basically walked up and down the pit lane and went into every motorhome with like a pen and pad and basically said, "Hey, Toto Wolff, sign this saying that you'd support us in Formula One. Hey, Mattia Binotto, sign this and say you'd support us in F1. Hey, Zach Brown, et cetera." You get my point. Mark, what's your take on this? Is this just like the Field of Dreams thing, the build it and they will come? Or I don't know. Dude, I have no idea.
What a great question. And I have to be honest and concede that I've kind of flip-flopped on this subject a little bit, that you go back to Miami in 2022, that the Andretti group was very clear that they want to join F1 and they were going to be very forceful about it. And I'll never forget that weekend. And there's photos of him with that pad of paper and the pen in, kind of insisting, like, you signed here, you agreed to us joining. I'm like, dude, this isn't how it works. Like, this isn't like a clubhouse up in a tree in somebody's backyard. Right. This is a multi-billion dollar sport with a ton of super invested interests. Like, you need to go through the proper protocol. And fortunately for him, the FIA opened up that appropriate protocol, and he went through that protocol, and the FIA, the sports regulator, looked at his submission and said, we sign off that this looks great, that we think this is a sustainable bid. We think he's got all the infrastructure, the people, the personnel, all the capital to make this successful. And then it was turned over to F1, to FOM and the teams. And FOM was basically like, no. And like you said, they were kind of grasping for straws, and their explanations were total BS. And I know we don't swear on this podcast, man, but like, it was total BS, because I think everybody knows what their objection was. Mm-hmm. And their objection was that the current Concorde agreement calls for a $200 million anti-dilution fee, a $200 million expansion fee, which may have made sense in 2020 when that Concorde agreement was struck. Doesn't make sense now. It should probably be a billion plus. And I wish FOM and the teams could have been honest and said, yeah, we think this is a great bid, but we need $1 billion. And if Andretti's willing to negotiate on $1 billion, let's do this thing. And if he's not, he can wait till we strike the next Concorde agreement and he can come back and negotiate with us. Like, just be honest with people, because it's horrendous. And like, I've got the list of the current constructors up here, man. Like, we talk about adding value to the sport. Haas has been in this championship since 2016. They have been a drainer on the credibility of this sport. They have been a straight up drainer on the credibility of the championship. They are a joke. And Williams, for all their historical value, my friend, they are a complete disaster. And I get it that we have to trust Dalton and they're going to do the right things, but they've clearly not invested any money in that team. They've had that team for what, 3 years now? What significant improvements have they made at Grove? Have they built a new factory? Are they building a new factory? And then we hear stories recently like, oh, we cataloged the parts for our cars, all 10,000 of them in Excel. Like they're clearly not doing anything to move the needle there. And yet you have a team like Andretti, a potential prospective team like Andretti, that's clearly willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. If they're willing to sign up for an anti-dilution fee that you are comfortable with, why aren't we doing this? Or why aren't we forcing the sale of Haas? Or why don't we remove Haas from the championship and replace them with a team that actually adds value? And maybe ultimately it's not even just the money. Maybe it's just the fact that, hey, if I'm one of these bottom six teams, I look at Andretti and say, well, not only am I not happy with the anti-dilution fee and my cut of that, but I anticipate that they will kick our rear end in the championship for the next decade, which means more money out of my pocket, which is, by the way, is what the anti-dilution fee is supposed to subsidize for. Yeah. But yeah, it's infuriating, man. It's so frustrating that you have this prospective team that is already probably better equipped and more capable than three teams on the grid, but that Haas gets a free pass to join the championship every year, despite being a total joke. And I'm stressing that they are a joke, man, to the championship. And yet they get a free pass every time because they were in the right place at the right time in 2016.
Well, that's just it, right? And I, as you were just kind of running through that, I couldn't help but to think to myself, if it were not for the phenomena of the initial drops of Drive to Survive and the fact that it made Gunther Steiner this cult figure, right? Would they even get like any recognition beyond that? Because I mean, they
great call.
And you made another good point there too, that, and I hadn't actually thought of that before, is that, you know, you've got those three or four teams that have that vested interest that if Andretti comes in, they could very well kick their butts up and down the length of the pit lane for a decade, which is a great point. I'd never actually thought of that. But, you know, it's funny because when you go back and I get the one argument that they made that they didn't have like a solid agreement in place for a power unit, right? And I know that Renault, which I put more on Renault than anything, because they kind of seem to be playing this, you know, sort of like the gray area. Because what was it? Bruno Famin was saying something. Well, we had a pre-agreement. Like, what the hell is a pre-agreement? You either have an agreement with someone. You can say to me, Hammy, you can say, well, you know, we're going to have an agreement in place to do this podcast every week or whatever it is. It's either yes or no. It's just like, well, can we agree to pre-agree that maybe we will do a podcast together? So, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And like, I don't, maybe I'm just too, you know, narrow in my thinking. Maybe it's just too binary. It's either yes or no, on or off. So there's that. But the one thing I found absolutely laughable when they had that, released that statement when they denied Andretti, saying that they felt that the Andretti brand would benefit more from Formula One in terms of exposure and marketing than the other way around. I'm just like, yeah, I guess to a certain extent, but this is, you know, these aren't people that have never raced before. These aren't people that haven't been successful before. This is Mario Andretti and Michael Andretti's like organization. I'm not even going to say a team because Andretti Motorsports, like Michael says, they've got their finger in literally every pie out there except Formula One. So I found that just like the most laughable reason. And I was just like, I'm not even like a part of like, I'm attached to the Andretti Motorsport group or in no way whatsoever, but I actually was like a little bit offended by that. I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, Mario Andretti, like even nowadays in North America, I would think to a large extent is a household name. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree on that. Yeah, one,
it was just really, really silly stuff. But in addition to the fact that they've bought this or moved into this 40,000 square foot facility, so they're also planning to enter Formula 2 and Formula 3 to basically promote U.S. talent and then eventually have like this pipeline to, you know, develop drivers to get from the lower formulas into Formula One. So that is, you know, amazing. So apparently if they do get their, you know, like the go ahead on the F1 project, it'll base their F2 and F3 teams at an adjacent site at Silverstone. I mean, it just, you know, if you didn't think that the Andretti project had anything to it or there was no substance to it, I think that any of those questions can just be now put completely to rest. And when you're talking about like a pipeline to develop drivers and develop talent, this is the way to do it. It's not to have a team and a B team and Red Bull and Visa Cash App, you know, whatever we're calling that, you know, the team formerly known as Toro Rosso is, because that is still the most ridiculous, you know, setup out there. You know, this is the right way to do it. F2 and F3.
Let me interject on this one. So I agree with those initial points that you made, that this is the right way to build a Formula One competitor, that you have your own infrastructure, your own Formula 2 team, your own Formula 3 team. You're sponsoring young kids in oval racing. You're sponsoring young kids in karting, and you have your own infrastructure to bring them through. So ultimately you have your own pipeline of talent, but you do it without stealing a grid spot from another team. So I'm going to keep talking because you're taking a phone call. But yeah, I completely, everyone's getting an inside scoop on the podcast. But Daly, you are completely right that they're doing the right thing. They're building physical infrastructure, bases in Canada or bases in the US, bases in Great Britain, which is of course where the power sports alley is. You are building infrastructure in Formula 2 and you're building infrastructure in Formula 3. We know they do a world-class job of identifying and cultivating talent. By the way, can people tell I haven't been on a podcast in a couple of months? A little rough, so I apologize.
All good.
But I just completely agree with you that they're doing this the right way. And again, the other thing about this, and I'd never thought about this, Daly, until you made this comment a couple of minutes ago, that it kind of reminds people that there's a way to develop talent and build infrastructure without stealing a grid spot from another team. So a couple of minutes ago, I said, look, what value is Haas adding? What value is Williams adding? I completely forgot about whatever that second Red Bull team is called, because I will never call them the Visa Cash team or whatever it is. Like, there's another team on the grid that is adding zero value, because we know that the intention of that team is to never win a championship. That Haas might be terrible, Williams might be terrible, but deep down, I know the people in those teams go to work every day inspired to win a championship. Nobody at that second Red Bull team goes to work every day thinking winning a championship is a possibility, because it flies directly in the face of the intention of Red Bull, which is for the Red Bull Racing Honda team to win. Like, it's just crazy. It's like, it's imagine if there was an NBA team and the NBA's team stated mission was to never win a championship because the owner owned another team. Like, that would never fly, man. And it's so frustrating that this is a, anyways, these are all rants people have heard before, but yeah, it just kind of further reinforces how terrible that situation is.
But you know, that's exactly the point, though, because, I mean, we've ranted about this the situation for literally years since, you know, going back to 2021, since we started doing the podcast together, right? And it's just perpetuated over this amount of time. I still think the most bizarre thing about this whole Red Bull, AlphaTauri, Toro Rosso situation, whatever you want to call it, is the fact, going back to, what was it, 2018, that one year where, or was it 2019? Where the one year that Red Bull had the Renault power units in their car, they had the Honda power units in the Toro Rosso, and they were, you know, they basically got to try before you could buy situation, because, you know, Bernie Ecclestone managed to arrange this strange deal to keep Honda in Formula One. I mean, which ultimately I think did benefit the sport, even though I'm not really a big fan of, like, you know, backdoor shenanigans and things like that, and, you know, backdoor deals and things, but, you know, because I don't want to know that deal really transpired. I mean, anyways, I think that, you know, out of all those different entities we've talked about, you know, Honda does have a very positive influence in Formula One, and it's good that they're here, but it's just a strange way that, you know, and it's not the right way to do it. That's why I'm excited to hear that that Andretti is doing all these things now. It's just like, Michael has come a long way from wandering up and down the pit lane with you know, a pen and paper, trying to get, you know, support from the rest of the paddock. I mean, what is it going to take for them to sign off? Is it exactly like you say, that they're going to have to wait until they sit down, renegotiate the Concorde agreement? Because it to me, that just seems what it is. It's that the rest of the teams have kind of like circled the wagon. It's just like, you know, we're going to lose too much money because reasons, and we don't want to leave let these guys in. Or is there more to it? You know, is it they just don't like Michael and Mario Andretti? Is it all of the above? I don't know. It's very, very strange, but it's like one of those situations I just can't help but, you know, watch intently, right?
I guess I'm just looking at the timeline here. So the eighth Concorde agreement was struck in summer 2020, so right during the height of the pandemic, and it's in force for 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. So I suppose that means we probably, the teams and at the FIA and FOM probably won't approach the new Concorde agreement until, well, I suppose they're probably talking about it now, but they probably won't be deep into it until the middle of next year, which is when you would expect them to start signing the agreement. So it would be in force for a period starting in 2026. Now, that said, the last Concorde agreement came together really, really smoothly.
Well, it did.
It came together really smoothly with the teams,
in the pandemic, FIA, nonetheless.
But I would suspect, man, that given where the relationship is between the FIA and FOM right now and the teams, that I think this is going to be a hyper partisan kind of battle, that I think this is going to be a very, very uncomfortable negotiation, because I think the FIA is going to try to exert more control over the championship. I think there's going to be a fight over money. I think there's going to be a fight over influence. So I think this is going to be a remarkably challenging Concorde agreement to get done. But I think what we will see is that anti-dilution fee for prospective new teams on the grid would probably be $1 billion plus. Now, all of that said, as much as I think that Andretti warrants a spot on the grid, had his timing been better, this could have been easy. Like you said earlier, he could have bought Sauber if he was willing to pony up more money, and we don't really know what those agreement kind of negotiations look like. He could have been on the grid in 2016 for nothing, because let's be realistic, Haas basically got a grid spot just because they showed up, because we needed a team as other teams were dropping off the grid. That there have been opportunities in the past where he could have been on the grid for little or no money. His timing was just bad. So on the other hand, I kind of still in the back of my head have this sensation that, look, you know what? I want you on the grid. I think you could add value. Your timing's bad. And do you only want a piece of it now because it's globally popular, or more globally popular than it ever has been before? But that said, we'll see what happens. But I, again, if the new Concorde agreement isn't going to be struck until 25, it doesn't go into force until 26, when do we see him on the grid? Is it 27? Is it 28?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, right? Because they've always gone with this working assumption that come hell or high water, they're going to be on the grid in 2026. That's just, you know, they've said, stated all the time. And that was one of the other things in that announcement a couple of months ago, that that Formula One just basically had it in their mind that Andretti was working towards a 2025 entry, which, you know, Andretti clarified to say, yeah, that's what we originally were targeting, was a 2025 launch date. But then it made no sense to develop a car for one set of like regulations, and then for the next year, a completely new car for a completely new cycle of rules and regulations. And they were pretty clear about that. But, you know, just kind of going back to your comments there about like the Concorde agreement, that was so weird the way like the last one came together. Like you said, it was all done in the summer of 2020. Of course, we were all focused on other things because that's, you know, the early, you know, really uncertain, nerve-wracking days of COVID-19, right? And it was just bizarre that this was, I mean, lots of things were like kind of like bylines to the main COVID news in those days. And, you know, those were dark days we all want to forget about. But it was, to me, it literally blew my mind that this happened when it did, when there was so much uncertainty, because it wasn't too long or too much longer after this was announced that Formula One started racing, because we had like a couple of back-to-back races in Austria, of course, in front of empty seats. We had a couple of races in Silverstone. We had like, what, a 17 race season that year, which was incredible. And but the other thing that we were overlooking, Mark, was that not only did they get that Concorde agreement negotiated at that time, they also managed to all sign off on the cost cap, which came into effect and has been, you know, tightening up each and every year over the past couple of years as well. So I really don't know what to expect for that. But you made a couple of really good points that you think this is going to be a really, you know, hard fought, really hotly contested, you know, set of negotiations between, you know, the different parties involved. And I can't help but wonder, is like, was a lot of that just kind of like deferred from like the last agreement, that, hey, maybe, you know, we're going to go into kind of like a strange period here. Who knows when things are going to get back to normal. So maybe some kind of agreement is better than no kind of agreement. And then during COVID is when, you know, so many people were sitting around at home and people discovered Drive to Survive and Formula One. And we saw that huge uptick in interest in 2021, 2022, and then kind of leveling off and then maybe slowly retracting in the last year and a half or whatever it is. But, you know, really, really fascinating stuff. Anyways, we're going to take another quick time out here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about your favorite team, VCARB, Visa, Cash App, Racing Bulls, or whatever it is. Well, not really, but we're not going to talk about the team, but we're going to talk about two people within the team, Danny Ricciardo and Yuki Tsunoda. So we'll do that in just a moment. So please don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. So one of the big topics of conversation, and, you know, I admit that I've, you know, had a soft spot for Danny Ricciardo, you know, over the years. I find him, you know, quite the amusing, refreshing personality, and having interviewed many athletes and sports personalities over the years, that he's always been a bit of a fresh air. And like a lot of people that know him say that the Danny Ricciardo that you see in media scrums, you see on TV, see on Netflix, Drive to Survive, that is that is him. You know, he's like that all the time. And that's, you know, not always my experience when it comes to, you know, interviewing athletes and personalities like that. But before we talk about Danny Ricciardo, I want to talk about Yuki Tsunoda, his current teammate at Red Bull Racing. Was it Racing Bulls? RB. Let's just go with RB. That's the easiest thing. Anyways, so he is supposedly on a different set or a different level when it comes to you know, his mentality and his approach to the season. And so RB team CEO Peter Bayer said that a couple of things when he was interviewed this week by motorsport.com when talking about Yuki's performance this past weekend at the Japanese Grand Prix at Suzuka. He said, quote, he said he went out with the samurai spirit. I think it was an amazing achievement for him in front of his home crowd in Honda. Somebody told me this for the first time for a local driver since 2012 when Kamui Kobayashi scored points in a Japanese Grand Prix. So a great achievement from Yuki, honestly. It was an immaculate drive from him, and he was managing his tires when he had that when he had to. He was pushing when he had to. He had great support from the team with that pit stop. Overall, very, very happy with him. Also, Bayer went on to say, quote, that's something that we've seen now for the past couple of races, and he's made such big progress mentally. Over the winter, he had made amazing progress physically, but mentally he's on a different level now. He's taking this up, and he's actually taking energy from it rather than being distracted. I think this was certainly a mega drive from him, end quote. So I guess what Peter Bayer is saying is that is little Yuki growing up? Is are we seeing him starting to mature? Because, I mean, remember, Mark, a couple of years ago in that first race in Bahrain, he goes out. I think he scored like a P9 or a P10 the first time we saw him in a Formula One car. We thought, oh, hang on, you know, we could be on to something here. And it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride with Yuki Tsunoda. And we got to know this, you know, get to see some different sides of him on Drive to Survive. And I think a lot of like the, you know, the quotes or a lot of the, not the quotes, but a lot of the criticism sort of leveled towards him was that, you know, I guess it was focus, right? I mean, we saw just, you know, the way that he was, maybe just maybe not taking things quite as seriously as he was. I mean, he was racing for, I guess it would be AlphaTauri at the time. He's living in Milton Keynes near to the Red Bull factory. But of course, RB is based in Italy. So he moves down there last year. And I always kind of like this, like the thing is like, well, you know, he's basically been grown up and raised by race engineers his entire life. It's like he's been raised by wolves or so. He's been living out in the wild, but I guess in motor racing terms, he has been. But I like what I'm seeing from Yuki Tsunoda. Like there's a definite edge to him. He seems more polished, and it's been fun to watch what he's been doing this year. It's just like I can't help but wondering if he's starting to, I wouldn't say so much grow up, but you know, mature and really starting to get a bit of polish on him now. This is what, his third year in F1?
You know, I think maybe I'll take a different angle on this, that through four races to start 23, and by the way, this is his fourth year in Formula One, so he has three
already.
Total.
Wow.
Yeah, 21, 22, yes. 23, so he actually caught the last year of the kind of prior regulatory period. But yeah, it's his fourth full season in Formula One. He finished, he had two top 10 finishes to start the championship last year in the first four races, and he has two points finishes in the first four races this year. That, you know, I get he's kind of accumulated a couple more points through four races, but his start in Bahrain and Saudi weren't great. I'm not convinced that, and I appreciate why we want him to be successful, that he's clearly a very talented young driver, but I'm not totally clear what his ceiling is, but I'm also not totally clear what he would be capable of in a better car too, because it's really difficult sometimes to benchmark that second Red Bull team and what the capabilities of that car are. So I think on the one hand, I want to be very critical and I want to disagree with you that I don't know that we've seen necessarily a ton of emotional and mental growth, certainly physical growth, because I think that's just a natural attribute of being around world-class trainers and things like that, which obviously he is, but I'm not sure that he's that much better mentally. And the problem is it's tough to know so long as he's in that car. But again, if you benchmark this year against his prior year, so you know, at 2021, he finished P14 in the Drivers' Championship. 2022, the first year with the new regulations, he finished P17, then P14. This year he's setting P11, but he only has 2 points finishes in the first four races. But having said that, if you can't kind of necessarily fairly comp him against the rest of the field, because I think it's probably fair to assume it's not a great car, even though we were promised that this year's Red Bull 2 car was going to be worlds better, right? That we had all that consolidation between Milton Keynes and AlphaTauri, and that there was going to be a lot more part sharing and knowledge sharing and all those kind of pieces. So it's maybe a little bit disappointing. But if you look at his teammate, Daniel Ricciardo, and this could be a natural transition to the next point, Daniel Ricciardo is not even on the radar in terms of being a reasonable, I would say respectable Formula One driver this year. That Daniel Ricciardo, obviously, retirement in Japan. He's struggling to keep the car on the track. A P13, P18, or P16, P12 in retirement. That Daniel Ricciardo is just in a different hemisphere of pain right now in terms of performance. So maybe I'm being unfair to Yuki, and maybe Yuki is significantly outperforming that car, and maybe Daniel Ricciardo is underperforming relative to the package that he's being provided. But if Yuki's only comp is Daniel Ricciardo, who himself is an established F1 driver who's won multiple Grand Prix, Yuki's crushing him right now, absolutely crushing him. So I think that kind of leads to two questions, which is one, what is the future for Yuki? If the team's happy with him, is the intent to keep him here forever? And is that what he wants? Or is he a potential replacement for Sergio at some point in the future? And then maybe the more immediate pressing question is, you know, we got a little bit of sample from Daniel Ricciardo last year. I think he had 1 points finish after he came back in the back half of the season. But ultimately, I think the question is, how quickly is Liam Lawson going to replace Daniel Ricciardo? And I don't know if I'm jumping maybe a little too early to that conclusion, but I don't know how you can build a business case to keep him in an F1 car, man.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's too early to have that conversation, because some of those, you know, those things have already been, I mean, he's been in the garage at RB at least the past race, if not two, you know, literally looking over at Daddy Ricardo's shoulder. I mean, you look at, so Yuki's currently now 11th in the Drivers' Championship. He's had two top 10 finishes. He was 7th in Australia, 10th in Japan, P14 and P15 to start the year in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, so not really all that that great. So I mean, he only has seven points to you know, for the season so far, I mean, but markedly improve over the past two races. I mean, like you'll compare with Danny Ricciardo, P13 in Bahrain, P16 in Saudi Arabia, P12 in Australia, and then one of the cars to retire in Japan on that first lap crash along with Alex Albon. Racing incidents, who knows what he could have done. I mean, he was only like, what, about 5 or 6 hundredths of a second off his teammate, you know, missing out and getting into the top 10 shootout. So I don't necessarily want to write off Danny Ricciardo, at least for the Japanese Grand Prix, because that one, I think we just kind of like exclude it. But from the other three races this year, you know, certainly not very impressive, like you say. And I mean, there's a really good article over on Planet F1 by Oliver Harden called "What Happened to Daniel Ricciardo? The Compelling Theories to Explain His Sharp F1 Decline." And I think there's a couple of really good discussion points that Oliver has in this article. So the first point that he has is he cashed out after leaving Red Bull. Point number two is he just can't drive mediocre/bad F1 cars. The third talking point is the McLaren stint messed with his mojo. And the last one in Oliver's article is the fear has just gripped him. So I don't know about the first one that he just sort of cashed out when he was at Red Bull. The last one, he's kind of like lost the edge and the fear has gripped him. I think there's something a little bit more to the second two in this article, that he just can't drive mediocre or bad Formula One cars, and the McLaren stint messed with his mojo. So certainly, I mean, he'd been, I think, fairly spoiled, or spoiled maybe compared to what the cars he has right now, because even back until 2018, like Mark, I still remember the day I was on my summer holiday on Vancouver Island. I remember sitting out in the sun, scrolling through the timeline on my phone, and I saw that now infamous video of Ricciardo announcing that he was going to leave leave at the end of the year, because it was so weird, because like just a week or two before that, like, or not even a week or two before that, literally like hours and the day before that, they were talking about just dotting I's and crossing T's on a new contract with Red Bull. And then all of a sudden he's off to Renault. And I mean, that was just a waste of time. I mean, apart from what was it, two podiums and that weird 2020 season. I mean, that was nothing to write home about. And then that kind of leads into Oliver's other point that I really kind of resonate with, and that, you know, that stint at McLaren really messed him up, despite the fact that he won the Italian Grand Prix that one year, which was, you know, perhaps maybe a little bit, maybe Lando was faster, maybe they should have let Lando pass Ricardo, but anyways, it is what it is. But I don't know your thoughts. Mediocre, the McLaren stint messing up. I think there's something to both of it.
I think there's something to all of it, and we'll probably never really know what it was unless he ultimately sits down at the end of his career and writes a book about his experiences. But I would argue that it could be something related to, I like that comment at the end about, hey, maybe it's the fear that's gripped him or the fear that's gotten him. And I'll share a story that, you know, if you've ridden a motorbike before, you know that it's an incredibly, incredibly mental affair. It's physical, but it's also incredibly mental, and you're thinking and you're thinking and you're thinking. And as soon as you start to overthink, or as soon as fear starts to settle in, it immediately changes all of your physical inputs, and you become slower, and you become surprisingly, ironically, more dangerous. And I think that there's a big physical piece to this, where he's probably significantly overthinking in the car, every lap, every corner. And I think as a result, he's probably a little bit more timid. So he's probably earlier on the brakes, he's later on the throttle, he's probably carrying less speed into corners, and then he's also more likely to make mistakes. But I think it's probably something that's mental. And to your earlier point, I love Daniel Ricciardo. He's a sensation. I'll always remember him as one of the most personable drivers in the history of the sport. I love him off the track. I love him off the track. But we kind of went through this in the back half of 2022 with McLaren, right? That it's funny, like if you go back to 2021, he started well, and I think he had points finishes in the first six or seven races of the year. He wins that race in Monza, and maybe ultimately he shouldn't have, maybe his teammate was faster, but whatever the case was. But it seemed to be all downhill from there, that he really struggled with the exception of a couple of top five finishes through the back half of that season. And then 2022 was a disaster. And I remember you and I in 2021 trying to unpack and dissect what was going wrong. And I remember, I think it may have been at Monaco where he shared these comments, which was, you know, in relation to his teammate, he's like, I can't figure out how he's braking so late going into corners with this car, and I can't figure out how he's getting so much speed coming out of the corners, which meant that, hey, maybe he just misunderstands the car, and this is mechanics, and he's going to be able to pick it up. But he struggled through the back half of that season, didn't get a ride going into 2023, and then of course we know what happened, that an opening became available at Hungary, and he was able to jump into that AlphaTauri, but he wasn't great. He did have that P7 finish in Mexico, but he wasn't great, and of course he had that terrible injury in the Netherlands, and of course he comes back month later. But of course, that just gave Liam Lawson this opportunity to absolutely shine in that car. Yep. And he looked amazing. Yep. And that probably even compounded the pressure on Daniel Ricciardo. But all of that said, I think we came out of 2023 and you and I were talking about, well, how long is it going to be until Daniel Ricciardo replaces Sergio Perez? That obviously that's what's going to happen here, that you want to open up that seat for Liam Lawson, and you open that up by moving Daniel Ricciardo into the Red Bull team. But now that we sit here four races into a marathon 24 race championship, it's pretty clear that Daniel Ricciardo is going to lose his seat to Liam Lawson. And I think that there's no one that could build a case for keeping him, and that Sergio Perez right now looks very safe in that Red Bull seat. And I think if Sergio was to get an extension at this point, as much of a surprise as it would have been if it had happened a year ago, it's probably likely at this point that Daniel Ricciardo is going to be the odd man out in that game of musical chairs at Red Bull.
Well, that's just the thing, right? I mean, the Liam Lawson story last year was the plot twist I don't think anybody expected to see coming, right? Because they had all these different options, because because obviously Nyck de Vries was a disaster and didn't work out. They put Ricciardo in, and all of a sudden he kind of shows like a couple of flashes of a couple of good moments there, getting back into the car after, you know, losing that that drive at McLaren, and then, you know, spending what was it, 8 months on the sideline. Olsen gets kind of called back into duty, and then it was rather kind of ironic that that crash that he had at Zandvoort was because the guy that basically took his seat at McLaren, his countryman Oscar Piastri, is the one that had the moment, and Daniel had to take the evasive action in the accident that ended up breaking his hand. But it's funny because this whole situation almost became a bit of a narrative that it just sort of made, you know, it was going to be, this is the way it's going to happen, that Perez is gone, Ricardo's getting his seat, Lawson is getting in, and who knows where Sergio Perez ends up after that's all gone, except like Perez is kind of demonstrated, like you say, he's like, well, I'm not quite done yet. And I mean, he's still not the greatest qualifier, but I mean, he's bringing home the points in the race, well, except for in Australia. But I mean, it seems like that regardless, whatever he and Max did, that perhaps, and that's a bit of a shame too, that Max retired when he did, because supposedly Ferrari had the pace and that they would have won that race regardless if Max had DNF'd or not. But the point I'm going to make now is that the way that the musical chairs are going to like kind of stop is exactly like you say, is that Lawson's going to get that seat. Perez is most likely going to retain that seat at Red Bull, and it's going to be Ricardo the one that that ends up without somewhere to go. The only thing that I'd like to add to this story is I just kind of wonder where Carlos Sainz fits into this picture. I would think that he has to be the leading candidate to take that seat at Mercedes, and I can't help but wonder if Carlos and his team maybe, you know, because I mean, he has that link to Red Bull, because I mean, he was a Toro Rosso driver before, way back in the day, right? So I mean, there are some links there. Would he really want to be second fiddle to Max? Would he really want to be like Valtteri Bottas to like Max Verstappen, like Valtteri was to Lewis Hamilton? Because I mean, if he was to take that seat at Mercedes, he would be the number one driver. Because I don't know, I mean, George, I mean kind of hard to say. I mean, what, because the car hasn't really been all that great, but I don't know. It'd be good to see George Russell, how he stacks up against another top driver. So I think there's a couple of things going on there too, Mark.
And Daly, I know you've done this exercise recently, but for the sake of the listeners at home, I'll just run you through it. So both Haas drivers are out of contract at the end of 24.
Yep.
Looks like both Sauber drivers are out of contract at the end of 24. Both of the Red Bull junior team drivers are out of contract at the end of 24. Logan Sargeant's out of contract at the end of 24. Both the Alpine drivers are out of contract at the end of 24. Fernando Alonso is just, I guess he's been re-signed, so he's under contract. Lance Stroll's contract status is unknown. If you look at McLaren, they're both locked up through 2026 plus. Obviously, Carlos Sainz is out of contract this year, going to be replaced by Lewis Hamilton. And then the Lewis Hamilton seat opens up, and then over at Red Bull, Sergio Perez is going to be a free agent. So yeah, I guess there's realistically three options for Carlos Sainz, maybe Mercedes, Aston Martin, and Red Bull, depending on what Red Bull wants to do. But I just feel like if Sergio Perez can continue to pin up P2 finishes, that you don't disrupt the cart at that team, that obviously we know their intention is to win drivers' championships, and they're going to do that whether it's Sergio Perez or somebody else. So why wouldn't you just keep Sergio Perez in there for the sake of consistency? Yep. So realistically, yep, you're right. It's probably Mercedes or Aston Martin. And then I think for Carlos, it's, hey, who's going to offer me more term? Who's going to offer me more money? And who's going to offer me a better package?
Well, that's just it. I mean, it's kind of funny because if you look at the way that the season has started so far, I mean, I don't think anybody expected to be Carlos to be the better of the two Ferrari drivers in terms of results four races in. Granted, it is only four races. I mean, we still have another 20 to go, but he's made, well, I mean, apart from the bout with appendicitis, I mean, other than that, I mean, he's made headlines for all the right reasons. And I mean, he's looked really, really good. I mean, and that's the thing. And I wonder, I mean, obviously he's trying to market himself to other teams and get a seat for next year. It's just, I'd love to kind of be in, you know, be a fly on the wall in some of these conversations, because I'm sure he must be playing all these, you know, three potential landing spots against each other, you know, Mercedes, Red Bull, and Aston Martin. And it'll be fun to see where he goes, but then also all those other different drivers that that are on a contract at the end of the year. You mean, honestly, I don't see, could you really see Logan Sargeant coming back? I mean, he's been, you know, second year now. I mean, hasn't really demonstrated, you know, very much at all. I mean, sure, he's driving to Williams, but look what Alex Albon's done in an equally just as, you know, a poor car that, that Logan has had. Bottas is an interesting one. I wonder where he might end up, because, you know, he's still, what, 34-ish or thereabouts. I'm not exactly, I know he's over 30, but I mean, he's not done yet. But, you know, the fun thing about you know, Valtteri Bottas, you know, Hammy, is that now that he's sort of a couple of years removed from the ultra corporate environment of a Mercedes, that, you know, I did realize that he kind of had like this cheeky personality, like that was at that Uber commercial that he did for you know, in front of the Australian Grand Prix. I thought was really good stuff. But I don't know, like it's interesting. Will he decide to sign another deal with Sauber to keep in that mix there with the, you know, to stay with Audi?
I don't think they're going to make that option available to him, man.
Really? Well, like, why is that?
I think, one, you look at his performance, it's been non-existent for sure. Like, he's developed this kind of cult social media personality and we've all kind of leaned into it. But I think that's maybe almost too compensate for the fact that his on-track performance has been so bad, and we know it's not the best car on the grid, but right now we're sitting P20 in the championship ahead only of Logan Sargeant, right? Like, I don't know how your agent goes to Sauber Audi and even kind of fronts that you're expecting a deal here. I can't imagine that they're willing to sign Valtteri Bottas. And I don't know what the alternatives are, but certainly there's better alternatives right now than Valtteri Bottas. Like, I think it's a stretch to think he's going to be back next year with any team.
Yeah. Well, what about Haas? You know, we were kind of slamming them at the start of the show, like both K-Mag and Nico Hülkenberg are out of contract. I mean, what benefit of it is it for them to sign somebody else? I mean, wouldn't they just be kind of like, you know, potentially like other, like, you know, like no-name drivers? It's like, why not kind of stick with the guys that you've had for the last couple of years? At least they're, you know, credible to a certain extent, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
When you bring up that Haas question, I get worked up, because it's just, what is the end goal with that team? They spend no money. They're not competing for a championship. So you might as well roll these guys back, because no, like, quality young driver is going to want to commit to that organization. And we saw how destructive it was to Mick Schumacher when he went there, basically destroyed his career before it could get started. That, like, what is that? Anyways, that's a separate conversation. But what are they doing? What is the end goal? You're not trying to win championships because you won't spend any money.
Okay. So fair enough. We won't talk about Haas. So before we wrap it up for this evening, like, another team that, you know, we should be asking is, like, what is your end game? What is your goal? Is Alpine, because apparently there's rumors now that apparently the Renault is willing to sell this team to I guess basically anyone that would buy them, with the, I guess, the provision that they you know, they buy or agree to a deal for Renault power units. It's just like, this, you know, man, this has been such a frustrating team to watch. And this has been going on a decade, right? Because they bought out
2015 when they came back. That's right. Almost a decade. That's right.
You know, because they bought the shell of whatever was left over from Lotus. And here we were 10 years ago thinking, hey, they're going to resurrect this team and do what they did, you know, which is going to be 20 years ago now, and won those two back-to-back championships with Fernando Alonso. But I mean, it's never, it's never materialized into anything like worthwhile, like not even remotely, ever since they've taken part. I mean, the only moment that they really had was those couple of podiums with Danny Ricciardo in 2020. And you know, all that weirdness, I guess the, you know, about a year and a half ago when they said that they'd signed Oscar Piastri, and, you know, Oscar was like, nope, no, you haven't. I'm not part of your team. Don't say that I am. And then they bring over Otmar Szafnauer and agreed to like 100 race, basically experiment or project with him, and then let him go not even a quarter of a way into that. And it's just like the same thing when you talk about it, it's just like what is Haas's goal? It's like, what is Alpine's goal as well? It's like, like, what has been their aim over the past 10 years? Because I'm not seeing it, Mark.
Yeah, it's, you know, it kind of makes sense from a business perspective that you would put the team up with the provision that you effectively remain an Alpine branded works team, that, you know, you can put whatever brand on the car. It can be Team Ryan Reynolds, Alpine Formula One team, or whatever you want. They're still going to supply it. But that's a pretty nuclear option, right? Like, you can buy this team, but yeah, you inherit, you're legally obligated to run the slowest power unit on the grid. and maybe Alpine comes to you and they say, hey, come check this out. Look at our 2026 power unit. This thing is a bomb. And you're like, okay, that's pretty good to sign up for. But the team will sell, and it's going to sell for a ton of money. And I think it'll set the benchmark for what the next expansion team would look like. And I think that the existing F1 team owners are probably pretty excited, because it'll help set a reference mark for the valuation of their own teams. And if Alpine goes for $1 billion, man, what is Ferrari worth? Although that would never sell. What is Mercedes worth? What is Aston Martin's worth? So yeah, I think it'll probably sell, and there's probably a ton of investors. The question is this the right thing for Andretti? Like, if he's going to spend $1 billion anyways, do you just buy an existing team and you can be up running right away? But does that not contradict or conflict with all the infrastructure that he's built, and how do you integrate the two things? And then if you're Andretti and you're already committed to partnering with General Motors, and that is a big part of your sales pitch for getting a team on the grid, and you're suddenly partnered and locked in with Alpine, like, how does that work? So it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see if a team does become available, what Andretti does and what his response is, because I'm pretty certain, in fact, I'm very certain that Alpine is committed to selling, but they're going to sell on the terms that you continue to be an Alpine works team for all intents and purposes, that they will continue to supply power units for the next 5 to 10 years, because I understand their development of the 2026 power unit is deep, and they don't want to write that off, that they don't want that to become a sunk cost. They want to be able to recoup that investment by selling those power units on to a team, and that would be whoever buys the Alpine Formula One team.
Yeah, you asked the question before I could even get the words out of my mouth. Is that the option for Andretti? And I'm thinking, maybe even 12 months ago, that's maybe the opportunity that they're looking for. But they, you know, with the announcements, you know, this week that they've got this new facility at Silverstone, they're planning to run entries in F2 and F3. It just, like, you know, why would you have like the facility at Silverstone, and that the Renault's based in Enstone, isn't it? I believe. Anyways, you know, you'd have like these two parallel facilities. Like, what would you do? Just, you know, take over and abandon one of them, and for the other? It's, I don't know. It just, to me, it doesn't seem like the reasonable, or maybe not reasonable, the logical option right now. At this point, it's just, it's, to me, the question is what does Michael Andretti know that we don't know? Because, I mean, they're acting for all intents and purposes that they're going to be on the grid in 2026. And, you know, like I say, I don't know if that's because it's the build and they will come mentality, or that, you know, maybe he knows he's checked off some boxes and some conversations that he's had with the people that will ultimately decide whether or not that Andretti Motorsport gets a Formula One, grid spot. Who knows? But I guess the question is that if Andretti decides no, taking over that Alpine team isn't the opportunity that we're looking for, then who would be the interested parties? Because remember, like last year, there was like another two or three like parties that were interested in launching or bidding for one of these Formula One, like or for another spot on the grid. Would one of them be interested and have the means to take over Alpine? It'd be I guess that's the more, I guess maybe the more pertinent question. If not Andretti, who would buy Renault or Alpine or whatever they call themselves? So who knows? All right, sir. Well, I think that's about it. Got right to the end of where we wanted to for tonight. Thank you, everyone, for joining in. Mark, it was fun as always to sit down and do this. And I'm right. I should, you know, I'm silly. I sat down. I should have realized that whenever we do a show together, that we're going at least an hour and a quarter. And, you know, like I'm completely parched out because I did not have the foresight to have a beverage here, which I've done for like about like 400 episodes that we've done previously. So that's completely on me. Anyways, thank you very much, Hammy. And thank you everyone for joining in. No race this weekend, but we'll be going back. I was going to ask you, Mark, that was one thing. We're going back to China next weekend for the first time in what 5 years. Are you excited to go back to the Shanghai International Circuit? Yeah, do you like that track?
I am. I was thinking about this in the shower of all places last night, that we hadn't even met. Like, just think about how the world's changed since 2000. We right? should probably have done a thing that, hey, these are the teams that have changed, these are the drivers that have changed, this is all the things that have changed in the world. But wow, is the world a different place than it was in 2019. But certainly, I'm excited to go back. I think that's a big, very important market for the sport. I'm super excited to see how the local fans and the national media in China respond to the fact that there's a Chinese driver on the grid now, which is pretty exciting. But yeah, for sure, I'm excited to go back there. I mean, I have good memories of the periods when we've raced there. I think the first race there was 04, maybe 04. So we raced there pretty consistently from 04 to 19. Yeah. I have a lot of friends that have enjoyed Formula One Grand Prix there in person. But yeah, I'm excited to go back, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one too. And I think that Zhou Guanyu is going to like assume rock star status the moment he puts a foot on the ground in Shanghai next week. I mean, you know, you always get the hometown team or the hometown driver in this case will always get all the love. So I'm sure we're going to see a lot of him next weekend as well. So, all right, let's park it there. Well, thank you, everyone. If you want to get in touch, by all means, what was our new handle on Instagram, because that's where we kind of transitioned to, and so we still got sort of maintaining things on X.
If you Google for Scuderia F1 Podcast on Insta, you'll find us. And I should also add, by the way, that I've been kind of working on a lovely little passion project of helping to grow motorsports in the Middle East, and Daly is actually going to be joining me on my passion project show.
Yes.
My co-host over there, Maram Al-Sheikh. So excited about that. But if you're ever interested in learning more about Formula 4 in Saudi Arabia or the UAE or some of the great things that are happening in that region, you can check that out. But Daly, hopefully you'll be able to join us in the next week or so. I'm super excited to get you on to that show.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that. When we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, I was like, yes, absolutely. Can't wait to do that and get involved. So just give me a time and place and a date and I'll be there. Well, obviously it'll be here because I guess
we'll be flying you out to Jeddah. So I've got a corporate credit card, so I'll make that happen. You'll be flying first class.
Yeah, I was going to say that kind of looks like your Starbucks card, but that I appreciate the gesture nonetheless. All right, everyone, have a great weekend, and we'll be back again very soon. If you want to help support the show, head on over to Spotify or Apple Podcast. If you leave a nice rating review, best way to help us grow the show, and we appreciate all the love. So enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.